America's most interesting people.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight we begin a most unusual experiment. Without fanfare or ballyhoo, we're going to introduce to you some people that you ought to know. We think that this distinguished group can aptly be called America's most interesting people. Everyone has a story to tell. There's human interest in every one of us. And yet every working day in this great nation of ours, there are people doing jobs, conducting businesses, and living lives that establish them as outstanding. They're different. On this premise, tonight you're going to meet the first gathering of America's most interesting people. A man who buys and sells anything and everything alive, from ants to elephants and rabbits to kangaroos. The world's number one air shopper. A woman who solves the problems of people who are in a hurry. A college professor who lends toys to children and is the head of a nationwide body of toy lending libraries. And finally, a charming lady who claims fame as the oldest chorus girl in the world. Who are these people? Where do they live? What made them different? Are they regular folks? Let's listen.
Look here, Smith. I've got $100,000 tied up in this show. I've got more to worry about than a pair of white French geese. As property man, that's your job.
Well, I know, Mr. Kent, but I've searched all over New York and I can't find a single pair. I don't know where to turn next.
Did you try Henry Krakauer?
No.
Well, call Chelsea 32830. He can get them for you. He's never failed me yet.
When in doubt or in need, call Henry Krakauer. That's what Broadway producers, animal lovers, motion picture companies, advertising agencies, and chefs have done for over 50 years. Mr. Krakauer, I don't like starting off this way, but something's been puzzling me ever since our interview the other day.
Yes, what is it?
Well, your slogan is selling everything and anything that's alive.
That's right, Jerry.
Well, now, how do you account for those 24 eggs you were shipping by airmail to South America? They certainly weren't alive.
Oh, yes, they were, Jerry. You see, those eggs were not just ordinary eggs, such as you eat for breakfast. They were from a special breed of chickens and were very much alive. They were hatching eggs with a certain spark of life in them.
But why ship them all the way to South America? Don't they have hens down there?
Of course they do, but not this special breed of hen. The gentleman I ship them to lives in Argentina. He is starting a special type of a chicken farm down there.
Well, how much did it cost to send them down there? How were they packed? And what did the eggs themselves cost?
Oh, wait a minute, Jerry. One at a time. The eggs cost $16.67 to express mail. It was the first time such an undertaking was ever tried. And we had to get special permission from the American Express Company. We packed the eggs carefully in sawdust. Billed to our customer, Red. 24 hen eggs, $25.
That's a lot of money for eggs, all right. Well, now, how did you get started in such an odd occupation, Mr. Krakauer?
Well, it was purely by accident. I had conducted a poultry business for a great number of years. Then one day, I got an order through the mail for 10,000 turtles. It struck me as being funny, but it was a challenge to see if I could supply this odd request. I found out that I could get them from a place in Long Island and also from Florida. And by the way, that was the beginning of the live baby turtle fad that is sweeping America now.
What are some of the other odd orders you've received in your time, Mr. Krakauer?
I can expect anything and everything at any time. However, I supplied an entire poultry show in the dead of summer for the Motion Picture Company. It was a perfect reproduction of the famous Madison Square Garden poultry show. In the wintertime, it would have been easy to do this, but in the summer, it's tough. The birds can't stand heat and die easily.
Well, I understand that many prestidigitators are your regular customers.
Yes, I supply most of America's famous magicians with their bunnies, their ducks, doves, and other animals they use in their acts. One of my best customers along that line was the late Thurston the Magician.
And who are some of your other customers?
Well, I suppose geese for the theater managers when they need them for farm scenes. Right now, I have an order from a Broadway producer for 2 white European geese for his play, which is opening soon. Then hunters buy decoy ducks for me also.
Well, I thought that all decoy ducks were made of cork or composition.
No, Jerry, some of them are very much alive. I only a certain kind of wild ducks can be used. They are called Muscovy ducks.
Well, now tell me about some more orders, Mr. Krakauer.
The other day, a big advertising agency wanted a special extra rich-looking turkey for a Thanksgiving cigarette ad.
Did they get it?
Yep. Drumsticks and all.
Well, now, what are some of the most unusual experiences that you've had in your business?
I once received 125 bullfrogs from a shipper in North Carolina, out of season. The fine for keeping bullfrogs out of season is $5 a head. I didn't dare sell them, so I called the aquarium here in New York City, and they were tickled pink with the offer. They said they had been looking for frogs such as these for several months and couldn't find them. I got rid of the frogs and made a friend at the same time.
Well, now, how long have you been in your present occupation, Mr. Krakauer?
I began business in the same location I am now in the year of 1883.
Wait a minute. Just how old are you?
I just passed my 70th birthday. I started in this animal business when I was 14.
Well, you're to be congratulated. And thank you very much, Mr. Henry Krakauer, for a delightful experience. The man who sells everything and anything alive, certainly one of America's most interesting people.
Calling the China Clipper. Calling the China Clipper. Hello, China Clipper. Calling the China Clipper out over the Pacific.
Hello, San Francisco. Hello, San Francisco. China
Clipper calling. Are you getting us okay? Hello, China Clipper. Yes, we're getting you all right. Give us your position, please.
Our position is 18 degrees north latitude, 171.6 west longitude. We figure about 1,600 miles out of Manila.
All right. We have a pickup order for you in Honolulu. Mildred Johnson of New York has a shipment of rare Hawaiian flowers that must make your plane. Do you get that? Please repeat it.
Hello, San Francisco. Pick up order of rare Hawaiian flowers for Mildred Johnson of New York. Now, can you give us the weather report?
Yes, here it comes. Slight westerly winds. Visibility 20 miles. Rare flowers from Honolulu. Lama cheese from the Andes. Caribou meat from remote Canada. Rattlesnake titbits from Texas. Olympia oysters that still retain the chill of Puget Sound. Choice steaks from Champion Steers in Kansas City. Stone crabs from Bimini in Yucatan. Teddy bears and parrots from Mexico. Smart gowns from Fifth Avenue. This imposing list of odd items is a small sample of the everyday business routine of America's number one air shopper, Mildred Johnson. Tell me, Mildred, where in the world did you ever get this air shopping idea?
About 5 years ago, I was traveling abroad mapping appealing air cruises in Europe for an American cruise company. It was while I was flying between London and the various European capitals that I noticed so many of the passenger seats occupied by packages. The European airlines seemed to be using the planes for an express service as well as passenger service.
So you decided that such a business would be a good thing in America?
No, I didn't give it much thought until I returned to this country. Then when Air Express became a general thing here, I decided to become an air shopper.
And what was your first order?
Stone crabs from Bimini for Sherman Billingsley of the Stork Club.
Why ship stone crabs so far? Aren't the Maryland variety just as good?
We have some very fine crabs up here, but the seafood of the southern waters are considered a much greater delicacy. Have you ever eaten pompano or green turtle from southern waters?
No, I haven't.
Epicureans say these are the finest in the world. This delicate stone crab meat would never last the regular boat or rail trip to New York, which is only an overnight jaunt by air. At 6 in the evening, the chef at the Stork Club phones us that he wants some Bimini crustaceans, and at 8 a.m. the next morning, they're in the restaurant kitchen.
Well, that's speedy service, all right. Tell me, do you have other customers for similar foods from the South?
I should say so. A number of the finer clubs feature Sunday evening southern seafood dinners through the air shopping service. Crabs, red snapper, green turtles, guava.
Well, now, getting away from food for a moment, Mildred, what are some of the other items prominently found on your air shopping list?
Flowers, jewelry, clothing, art treasures, animals.
Well, now, I can understand jewelry, artwork, and clothing and animals being flown, but how about flowers? Wouldn't they wilt and die?
Well, you forget, Jerry, that the whole idea behind air shopping is getting the items from their native surroundings, where they not only are cheaper, but hardier than our domestic flowers. In most instances, they grow wild.
Well, what are some of the flowers that you fly in?
giant roses from Colombia, South America, also orchids from there and nearby countries, pikaki, ginger, and jasmine from Honolulu, Easter lilies from Bermuda, orange blossoms from Florida and California, as well as the adopted state flowers from every state in the Union.
You mentioned flowers being cheaper. I'd think that flowers flown from such great distances would be more expensive.
Well, anything you buy in these foreign places is cheaper at its source. Air travel is not as expensive as one imagines. Therefore, I can sell you a gorgeous orchid that will last longer, look better, and is often larger than the domestic flowers, for a sum well under the market price here.
Well, now, come, Mildred, let's get down to figures. How much exactly are there? I might want to buy one sometime.
If an orchid sells for $1.50 here, I can sell you a South American orchid for $1.20. And your girl will get a double thrill because you can tell her that you had it flown all the way from South America for her.
Well, that has a very romantic touch to it, hasn't it?
Most decidedly. An air shopping places on each gift or item that is flown from some other city or country a tag which logs the flight of the plane chronologically, showing the exact path of flight, places it stopped, and the number of hours elapsed from start to finish.
Mildred, tell me, what was the most unusual article that you've ever been asked to supply for air shopping?
The most unusual was the request of a mine foreman in Pennsylvania to get a parrot that spoke four or five different languages. You see, the men in his mine were all foreigners and wanted a mascot that spoke German, Italian, Spanish, and English.
Well, that was really a tough assignment. Did you get the parrot?
Yes, sir. I searched for almost a month and finally discovered a parrot that spoke three languages living on a ranch in Mexico. I bought him and flew him to the mine foreman, and as far as I know, the whole company is having a linguistically good time.
What is the furthest distance that you've flown articles for your service?
I do a regular business with the Hawaiian Islands, which is some 6,000 miles from here. But the furthest was some rare orchids from the Orient. These flowers are pure white and only found there. A flower specialist asked for them. And on the same trip back via the China Clipper, I shipped some black coral jewelry from the Philippines.
Well, now, great care must be taken with these rare flowers. Aren't you afraid of the handling during the flight?
No, the airway companies cooperate to the sixth degree. They water them and keep them in a cool place so as to aid them on the trip.
What was another interesting experience you had in shopping for other people?
One afternoon in the dead of winter, I received a phone call from a doting grandmother way up in the northern end of Vermont. She wanted her little grandson to have a Texas horned toad for a pet. The lad had been reading Western stories and wouldn't rest until he had one, so I got one for him. That was a simple request.
Do you have any outstanding orders for certain foods or flowers?
Yes. Every year at Christmas time, I send a man in Puerto Rico a choice steak from the best blue ribbon champion steer sold at auction in Kansas City. This steak, after hanging for 3 months, is in the primest condition and sells for $5 a pound. It is the finest piece of meat of its kind in the world.
Well, the next time Mildred the Butcher doesn't give me a decent steak, I'll call you up. Well, now, what else?
Well, some of the biggest hotels here have regular evenings devoted to Hawaiian foods and flowers, which I supply for them direct from the islands. A few customers in New England who used to live in the South have special southern food shipped to them regularly. I am also doing a large business in coffee now.
Coffee? Wait a minute, Mildred. Coffee is rather a heavy item. How much of it could you fly in without it costing you as much as the plane?
Well, I receive more than enough for a single cup, Jerry. Bogota, Colombia coffee is the quality coffee of the world, and people who want the very best buy it from air shopping. We get the first pick berries and ship them partway by air, guaranteed fresh. Imagine being able to say to your house guests, "This coffee you are drinking flew in from Colombia last Tuesday."
Well, I've come to the conclusion that your business of air shopping is definitely a quality business. Am I right, Mildred?
Absolutely. The speed gives you the freshness and the rarities of the world without you moving a step. We do a quality business, but not necessarily an expensive one, because the original price in most cases is so low.
Well, now, two more questions. Do you fly yourself?
Yes, I've flown all the routes I buy from, some 250,000 miles of them. I've piloted my own plane in the past, but I don't get a chance anymore.
Well, now, what was the funniest happening in your entire career thus far?
A man in the Middle West wanted an insurance policy against the contingency of multiple births. You know, afraid of twins or triplets. He was in a terrible hurry, so I obtained the insurance policy and sent it special airmail, and as far as I know, the airplane beat the stork by several hours.
Thank you, Mildred Johnson, America's number one air shopper. The world is certainly your oyster, and you're definitely one of America's most interesting people.
Your name, please?
Ruby Toriel.
Where do you live, Ruby?
241 Hester Street.
Have you taken out any toys before, Ruby?
Yes.
Just a minute. Ruby Toriel, 241 Hester Street. Responsible child, okay. All right, Ruby. What kind of a toy do you want?
A doll.
Here you are, a lovely doll. Isn't she pretty?
Yes, she is. Thank you.
You're welcome. But remember, Ruby, to bring the doll back at the end of the week so other little girls can play with it, too.
I will.
Underprivileged, dead-end children taught the simple privileges of any child. A ray of hope in a cruel wilderness. A wilderness which has become an intense social problem in every huge metropolis. A Santa Claus in modern dress. A quiet, unassuming man who goes along the even tenor of his ways, distributing laughter and happiness as he moves. I want you to meet Dr. Harold Axworthy of New York University, the man who originated and guides the destinies of America's only toyery. Doctor, would you please explain that word, toyery?
Well, the word itself is simply a derivative of the word toy. To be precise, it's a gathering place of playthings of value.
A toy shop without a cash register, am I right?
Absolutely. Our toyeries do not sell or rent toys to youngsters. We simply lend them.
You mean, Doctor, that you have a room full of wonderful toys and that you allow any youngster to come in and borrow one and play with it?
Well, not just any child. Only underprivileged children. Children who never had a toy of their own or a chance to play with a real toy. Why, do you know, Jerry, there are thousands of little ones in the United States, especially in the big cities, who have never seen a doll or a set of blocks, let alone know how to play with them.
It seems incredible, Dr. Axworthy, that in this day and age, with motion pictures and radio, that such a thing would be possible.
Welfare organizations do a yeoman service for the kiddies at Christmas time, but that's just once a year. And even then, many children are missed because there just aren't enough toys to go around.
And that's where your toyery comes in, isn't it, Doctor?
Yes, we bridge the gap from Christmas to Christmas. Our toyeries run 365 days a year. There are plenty of articles to keep any youngster happy and busy.
You mentioned toyeries. Are there more than one?
Oh, there most certainly are. We are an international organization. There are toyeries in Canada as well as the United States, and in many cities that we haven't a record of. You see, being a non-profit organization, naturally the idea is the thing. We can't send delegates to further this work because we receive no dues from any of the other groups. The only help we can give the new chapters is the benefit of experience.
Well, where did you get this wonderful idea of creating a lending library of toys for children?
Well, the idea belongs to a social worker who was a friend of mine. In her daily calls, she noticed the appalling conditions in which children lived and the still worse conditions in which they played. In most cases, they lived in dank tenement buildings and dirty, dark hallways, staircases, and alleyways with their playgrounds. My friend came to me with the idea, and we developed a plan. It was 6 years ago that the first toyery came into existence. It was located in the New York University Community Neighborhood House.
Where did you get your toys?
Well, private individuals donated old toys that their own children had outgrown or broken. We mended them, put on a new coat of paint, and placed them in our stock. Department stores, too, donated toys that were outmoded or slightly shop-worn. The biggest source was the toy manufacturers themselves. When we approached them for a few toys, they plunged into this crusade with a zeal that overwhelmed us. Instead of a few toys, we received their surplus stocks. And not only the individual manufacturers cooperated, but the entire association of toy makers joined hands to help us. It was and is one of the most gratifying experiences I've ever encountered.
All right, Doctor, we have the idea and the toys. Now, where do we go?
Well, housing this idea and the toys is next. Naturally, we haven't any money, so the room must be a gift also. This room or storehouse may be in a settlement house or a recreation center or schoolhouse or a private residence.
Well, now, how do you get children interested?
That was simplest of all. Naturally, at first, it was an experiment, so we couldn't take every child that wanted to enroll. Our first children were obtained by telling teachers in grade schools in the neighborhood of the toyery of this service and asking their help by sending the children who were without toys. Word quickly passed around, and we had more than enough youngsters all the time.
Well, now, how exactly does this work when a child comes in for a toy?
Well, first of all, the toys are cataloged and tagged. A child's mother or father must come in with them and sign for the toy just as a precaution. That makes it appear more businesslike and places the responsibility on the parent and the child. And then we start the child on the simplest kind of a toy. Very inexpensive, and one that, if lost or broken, will not cause a great loss. If the child shows a sense of responsibility, we graduate him or her to a better class of toys, more colorful and expensive playthings.
Tell me, Dr. Axworthy, do any of these children ever show a special aptitude for playing?
One case was most interesting. We had several toy pianos available for the kiddies. A little girl came in one day and asked if she might play with one. I gave her a toy piano, and she played with it all afternoon. Next day, the same thing happened, and the next, and the next. This interested me, so I watched her more closely. This little girl was actually playing tunes on that cheap little tinkly toy piano. I asked her if she'd like to play on a big piano, and well, she was delighted. So we arranged for her to take lessons, and today that young lady has a fine concert career ahead of her.
Can you think of another interesting example of a similar case?
Well, Jerry, one of the most pathetic was the Polish woman who brought her little girl to us for a doll. This child had never seen a doll. The amazement at seeing this doll was, well, it was almost too much for both mother and child. Neither knew how to hold it or play with it. So one of our young women showed these two how to play with a doll. They spent the entire afternoon and many after that marveling at this wonderful toy. It was heartbreaking to think that here was a child who had never had the delight of the simplest kind of playing. There are many more where she came from.
Do you find any racial discrimination amongst children?
Oh, there's never discrimination amongst children, only among adults.
Well, now, Doctor, what are the most popular toys?
Well, dolls, doll carriages, and manipulative toys.
Are there any taboos in toys?
Oh, yes. We do not allow any toy guns in our toys. These children are raised in the breeding ground of crime, and we will not encourage it.
Do any of the children ever steal the toys you lend them or forget to bring them back?
No, very seldom. Because a child knows that once his privilege has been revoked, he can't obtain any more toys. And this is the greatest punishment in the world to children who haven't any playthings to begin with.
What hygienic precautions are taken with these toys, Doctor?
Well, the toys are washed in a special antiseptic solution and allowed plenty of sun baths. If a child has been seriously ill and played with a toy, we naturally destroy the object.
Are you married, Doctor?
Yes.
Do you have any children?
Yes, we have a boy and a girl.
Now, one more question. What is the future of this organization of yours, and what are its handicaps?
A Toy Reincorporated should become a part of every settlement, welfare, and recreation center. It's a sound principle for aiding child delinquency. Its handicap is lack of sufficient toys and room. And I'm hoping that these problems will work themselves out with the passing years.
Thank you, Dr. Harold Axworthy, founder and president of Toy Reincorporated, a job which helps children enjoy the simple pleasures of life. It's a pleasure and a privilege to add your name to the roll of America's most interesting people. Right at the top of the list of America's most interesting people can be found the name Mrs. Maria Savage, the oldest Corrine in the world. A charming lady who's never missed a performance at the Metropolitan Opera for the past 30 years, who's been singing in and out of the chorus since she was a petite miss of 21. Mama Savage is what she has been affectionately called by the great opera stars from Nellie Melba and Enrico Caruso down to Lily Pons and Lawrence Tibbett. Madam Savage, how does it feel to be known as the oldest Corrine in the world?
I don't like it, but I don't resent it either.
Well, I think you should feel terribly proud. You not only have a long, distinguished career to look back on, but a definite achievement ahead.
Young man, the oldest chorus girl in the world is one title which no one will ever dispute. A boxing title, yes. A speed record, yes. A bathing beauty title, yes. But a chorus girl, oldest chorus girl, no.
Well, have you any objection to telling your age?
None. I'm 74 years old. I was born New Year's Eve in 1864. When a woman gets past 50, she ceases to lie about her age. She just skips the whole thing.
What prompted you to get into opera?
The school authorities in Namur, Belgium, when I worked as a teacher, objected to my giving concert. Said it was a disgrace to the art of teaching. So I resigned and went to the opera house for a job. I was determined to show them.
And did you get a job right away?
Yes. The manager of the school, of the opera house, knew my father, who was like the chief of police in this country. So the manager thought here was a good chance to feature a local girl and boost up the local interest.
And was your debut a huge success?
Yes and no.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, I hadn't told my family about my quitting my job to become an opera star. When they heard about it, after the opening, my father never let me return. My brother won't speak to me to this day.
Well, I should think they'd have been very proud of you.
People in the opera and theater of that early day of 1874... 1887 had bad reputation, and my father thought opera was a den of iniquity.
Well, where did you go from there?
My father had me fired from several jobs in nearby cities where he had influence. But finally I got a job in the chorus of the Royal Theater in Brussels. About that time, the English were introducing opera in native tongue So I was given a job at Covent Garden. I loved London.
And you met your husband there, too, didn't you?
Yes, and not long after we were married, he obtained a fine post in Pershing. And while we were there, I sang before the great Shah of Pershing. He honored me by calling me a bulbul.
And what does that word bulbul mean in English?
The first translation I got was that it meant nightingale. Then one day, while strolling in a large park in Pershing, I heard the native berating a poor jackass. He was calling him bulbul. I found out later the bulbul meant both nightingale and jackass. I've often wondered just which one of two Shah meant for me.
And tell me, when did you come to America?
I returned to England and the opera not long after my Persian holiday, and then learned that Mr. Gatti of the Metropolitan was organizing the finest chorus in the world. I was invited to come over. I arrived in the summer of 1908.
And have you always been in the chorus, Madam Savage?
Yes, except for several small occasions in Europe and this country when I sang minor roles. And once I sang the lead in Martha. I'd like the chorus better. I have no regrets that I am not a star. The chorus is the real earthy part of the opera. We represent the people, young and old. The ballet represents youth.
And how many are there in the chorus of the Metropolitan?
There are 94, 45 women and the rest men.
And what are their various ages?
The youngest are about 23. The oldest, well, I'm the oldest, 74.
Do most of the people who enter the chorus do so with the idea of becoming stars?
Yes, I think so. But after two or three seasons, when nobody faints or drops dead, they become resolved and become excellent choristers. A good chorister must never think of his voice. And a person who is thinking of a career is always worrying about his or her voice and is therefore not a good chorister.
Well, your daughter's a member of the chorus, isn't she?
Yes, I told her before she began that to be in the chorus is no disgrace. We are an important part of the show, and it gives you a chance to earn a decent living among decent people.
Madam Savage, what is your favorite opera?
I have two that I like better than the rest. The first is the Meistersinger, and the second, Manon.
And what about your favorite stars? Who would you say in your long experience was the greatest of them all?
I have worked with them all the great ones. But the greatest to me was Nellie Melba and Enrico Caruso. Next, I would place Lily Lehman, and of the new crop, Lily Pons. Lawrence Tibbett is a hard worker and one of the country's great opera stars.
What is the difference between the old stars and the new ones?
The new generation refuse to study enough. They study several years and think that's enough. But the great ones study their whole life through. Hard work makes a great artist.
Tell me, do you like America?
Mr. Lawrence, I love America. America is friendly and democratic. People give here a chance, not like in Europe. Things are always in a turmoil over there. This is the greatest country in the world.
What's this I hear about you planning to retire?
Yes, I wanted to this year, but I have been too busy. And my friends want me to give a farewell performance when there is plenty of time and no rush. Already many of the people who attend the opera have sent me gifts. I am terribly grateful to them for remembering the old lady.
And what is your final word for a long, successful life, Madam Savage?
Plenty of God work and above all, a sense of humor. Always be ready to laugh and see the bright side of the life. And life will be beautiful and bountiful.
Thank you, Mama Savage, for a delightful interview. There's no doubt that as the years roll by, you will continue to be one of America's most interesting people. Tonight we've brought into your homes the first group of America's most interesting people. People who command that title because of their achievement of doing something unusual and outstanding. Did you enjoy meeting these individuals and listening to their stories? Stories crammed with human interest? If you did, join us next week at the same hour when again we'll bring you another imposing list of America's most interesting people. At that time we'll find out where to buy anything from frozen flies to baby carriages. How to repair a bagpipe or to find a dentist for a cub lion. This young lady's name is Peggy Matthews, and she's the modern oracle. We'll also meet Michael McDougal, the world's only card detective, a man who makes his living by beating crook card sharks at their own game. We'll meet America's only big league woman baseball scout, Mrs. Roy Largent, who will tell us about her profession. And last but not least, you'll meet Kenneth Lynch, a custom tailor for suits of armor, a steel wardrobe maker for actors, movies, and explorers. This is Jerry Lawrence closing the first file of this new program, America's Most Interesting People. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.